The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Escape to the forest and make unforgettable memories together.
There's nothing like a distraction of a Sunday night. It generally happens to be on a Sunday, though you can now stream it whenever you want, really, to watch these beautiful programmes like Blue Planet and Planet Earth. Who are the men and women behind the camera? Why do they do it? And how long does it take to bring a minute of that to our television screens? Let's talk to one such man. It's Doug Allen. Good morning to you, Doug. Nice to talk to you this morning.
Yeah, good morning, Ryan.
Tell us a little bit about your beginning, because you weren't always destined to be underwater with a camera, were you?
No, not really. Although not with a camera. I did get into diving. I got into diving when I was at school, and that led me to marine biology. But I always wanted to be, where the underwater, basically. So I started working with scientific expeditions and got this wonderful job in the Antarctic, working as a research diver down there, helping the scientists to gather the data. And it was at the end of one of my contracts in the Antarctic that David Attenborough and a film crew came to our station for a couple of days, and it fell to me to help them. And it was that experience with David that opened my eyes to the possibilities of combining diving with photography and all the excitement and great worthwhile stuff that David and the crew seemed to be doing. So I moved direction from shooting stills to shooting movie, and it was great. That was in the mid-80s, let's say. And it's been a great time ever since.
Well, I could imagine. It's funny, David Attenborough, as the years roll by,
right.
He's attained to celestial status, hasn't he?
Well, he is. I mean, there's no one comes close to David in terms of the profile that he rightfully carries. I mean, David has been making films since the 1950s, or involved with broadcast since the 1950s, and he has seen the changes in the world, and he has been responsible for bringing some of the most memorable series and sequences within those series, you know, to the eyes of everyone. So he's had a massive influence in making people aware of the environment.
In the years that you're filming wildlife, how many days of patience and tenacity are required to bring about a minute of that to the screen?
Well, we have a rule of thumb. Obviously, you know, when you have a film, you have a certain amount of budget. And the rule of thumb that the production manager and the producers work to is that if you put someone like me into the field for eight days, we'll come back with a minute on the screen. So simply to get one episode of something like Frozen Planet, you could be looking at 400 filming days. So they're massive logistics exercises to get the people into the best place, to give them the chances to grab the sequences. But of course, you're not always successful. So all the while that the production is going on, it's kind of like trying to nail jelly to a wall. You're getting some things, you're losing others. Some are better than you expected, some not. And so it's always a moving target.
And it's wildlife, it's the animal kingdom, it's weather. You are absolute, and here you are as human beings with all the arrogance that we carry, rolling in saying, okay, camera's on, now cue the whale. You know, it's not going to happen necessarily that way.
No, that happens in dramas, you know, where you can script everything. But yes, when you're dealing with the natural world, there are really only two rules, you know, that we follow that keep us sane. The first thing to remember is that you can only be in one place at one time. So you're up there in a cabin trying to film polar bears. You leave in the morning, you look all day, you can't find polar bears. You come back at night and there's footprints all around your cabin. But, you know, you just try to accept that. Some days we won't go to the right place. But the other thing to remember is if you're not there, if you're not out looking, then you'll certainly never see it. So you need to take a chance. You need to show tenacity. And sometimes it becomes remarkably simple. We as camera people just have to get out there in the field and be ready to capture what we get. But also bear in mind that we may well not get as much as we hope to.
Talk to me about whales, Doug, and your admiration for them as one of the great creatures in the world.
Whales are magnificent. Whales are mammals, like you and I. And the thing to remember about whales is that they are mammals. They have personalities. They have individual personalities. Every whale species is slightly different, but within that species, you will have individuals who are different. And if you can find a friendly whale, someone who accepts you, someone who trusts you, someone who will get on, a whale who will get on with natural behaviour while you are there in front of it. And don't forget as well that working underwater, we have to be much closer to our subjects than we do on land. On land, we can use long telephoto lenses, we can hide in blinds. You can't do any of that underwater. Mm. When you can see the animal can see you. So there's this wonderful chemistry that can develop between you and the whales. And of course, whales, if you come up to things like killer whales, they have such sophisticated, beautiful, elegant behaviour that we're only just beginning to see the range of behaviours that they make. And of course, it's wonderful when you get the chance to film a piece of that behaviour for the first time. I mean, that's every camera person's holy grail. Mm. And quite often underwater, with the new techniques, the new tools that we've got, drones, for example, that let us look down on what's happening down below, then that's why you're seeing a lot of new stuff for the first time.
You know, I was watching the whales manoeuvring towards a seal on an ice floe recently, and you may have filmed this actually, because it. But I've never seen anything like it. It was like synchronized swimming on a murder hunt.
Exactly. No, we filmed that. We covered that first for Frozen Planet yes. 1, and then they did it again for Frozen Planet 2, but with the addition of drones, which allows you to see more clearly what the whales were doing underwater. And yeah, when you think, Ryan, about the degree of intelligence and communication that these animals have to show, to first of all go into the ice to find certain seals, to identify a floe that's not too big so that they can wash the seal off, etc., and then four or five of them coordinating their actions to produce a wave big enough. And then they also showed this lovely behaviour where sometimes the ice floe that the seal is on, there'll be lots of ice round about it, and that lots of ice round about makes it harder to generate the wave. So the whales actually put their nose against the ice floe and push the ice floe into more open water where the wave can be more effective. Now, the amount of decision-making that these whales are making is just remarkable.
Yeah, it truly is. And, you know, when you watch, if you ever watch Gogglebox watching these programs, they always begin with this, oh, the cute whale, and then you realise it's a brutal banquet, and off they go.
Well, animals, some animals are evolved to hunt other animals. That's how they live. And when we're filming it, it is hard to watch sometimes, a killer whale's separating a young grey whale from its mother and then drowning the young whale. I mean, that can, it's full of emotion and things, but our job is to be there and to observe something that may be being seen for the first time. And we need to separate our emotions to some extent to make sure that through our teary eyes, we're at least keeping the thing in focus.
I'm intrigued by the idea that you can become friendly with a whale or recognisable to a whale. This happened to you in Tonga and with the humpback whales. Talk to me about that and how that works in practice.
Well, the thing with humpback whales is humpback whales are among, they spend a lot of time at the surface, often humpback whales, doing interesting things. But when they dive and throw their tail up, if you get a look at the underside of a humpback whale's tail, then you'll see a pattern of black and white splotches on it. And that pattern is unique to that whale. So it means that in somewhere like Tonga, you can actually go out looking for specific whales. And we'd met this one whale on a day, and the whale was beginning to get quite friendly. So we were able to go out to this bay, and it wasn't always that we found it, but we did find it quite often enough. Often enough that I'm sure the whale recognised our boat and wanted to spend time with us. When we went into this bay and just pottered around quietly, this one whale would come over and she would lie right underneath the boat while the boat was just idling. And I would slip into the water, swim over to her, and she would come up with her calf, and she would come within a metre of me and look at me with that big eye. Her eye was about the size of a grapefruit. And obviously, you can't talk to her, but just like there's an awful lot passes between you and a dog when you get to know the dog, so it was between me and this whale. And she would chill out. She might go to sleep. And the calf would be swimming around, flapping its tail on the surface. And it just gave me a wonderful chance to get close-ups of the behaviour, but also close to the animal. And of course, the thing when you're in the water is that you can fly underwater too. We're all rooted to the ground when we're filming on the surface, but when you're swimming in the water, you can dive down, you can swim round about the whale. And so to swim next to a 45, 50 ton whale and have it watching you and quite happy to accept you round about it, it's an enormous privilege and an enormous chance to really get to feel at home with this animal in the water. It's just magnificent.
It just sounds like the whale said to the calf that morning, there's some weird creatures up here I want you to come and have a look at. It might be useful to you in later life. And you equally hopping out of the boat going, there's some magnificent creature here I want to look at. Like everyone's investigating.
No, absolutely, absolutely. I was in the water, you know, with some belugas once, which are smaller white whales in the Arctic, and they're very, very vocal. They make lots of, it's like being in the middle of a flock of birds when you're in the middle of a pod of belugas. But eventually I had this one in front of me, and I could tell that most of the sound I was hearing was coming from this one whale. Now, they have a big sort of rounded forehead, and they produce sounds in that part of their head called the melon. And at one point when this whale's looking at me, I swear blind, there were a couple of creases ran across the melon, and they're exactly the kind of creases that would appear on your forehead if you were talking to someone in a foreign language and they didn't understand what you were saying. Your forehead would crease in, you know, frustration, partly, yeah. You know, I'm trying to talk to you. And, you know, I think those whales, it wouldn't surprise me. I like to think that those whales were trying to communicate with me. And there is a giant multi-million project going on at the moment with sperm whales in Dominica, with the intended aim that by 2026, we will be able to communicate something to those sperm whales and we will understand what they say back.
That's extraordinary.
Which I think is magnificent.
Oh, yeah. It truly is.
Magnificent.
Because I often watch these programs and when David Attenborough says something as a commentator or voiceover, like these are the balls, you know, and he's talking that beautiful tone and that kind of grandfatherly reassurance, mm-hmm. if you like. But here's my question. It's not cynical, but it is questioning, which is how much should we worry about applying human emotions to the animal kingdom? You know, we might say, oh, look, there's a beautiful butterfly and there's a frog. And next thing you know, the frog has the butterfly in his mouth and chewing it up. But a minute before, because we read fairy tales and we've all are grown up with lives where polar bears are kind of lovely and seals are this and the other. But actually, they all have quite vicious teeth and they get hungry and they kill things that we might have thought were very cute.
Well, as I say, I mean, you know, I think it's important also to remember that we ultimately are animals as well. And a lot of the things that we, the ways that we behave have their parallels in animals. But I think the more that we understand about animals, and particularly perhaps about mammals, we're knowing that it's perfectly reasonable now to describe what these animals do in a very human way. Mm. You know, they do repay each other's favours. They do cooperate with each other. They do remember what's been happening to them. And I think that we need to be sensitive to this, and we are becoming more sensitive to this. And I think we're also, it's not outlandish now when people say that, you know, plants communicate with each other in a very different way from us. And there was a book came out recently that looked at all the different ways that animal senses work and how they can communicate with us, communicate with each other in ways that we can barely understand. I mean, we're highly visual, whereas whales underwater are highly vocal. They rely on sound much more. But for example, you know, male humpback whales will start singing in the breeding season. We're not quite sure why, maybe to impress a mate or something like that. But we now know that a male humpback whale in the Caribbean is capable of making sounds that are powerful enough to carry across the ocean and be heard by a humpback whale off Ireland.
Good Lord.
If the sea conditions are right. Now, I'm not sure if they can do that now because the oceans are so much noisier than they used to be. But certainly in the days when it was just sailing ships sailing across the world, then if a humpback whale got into the right strata, the right level of water, then it would give out a sound. That sound would bounce internally within that layer of water and could carry across the Atlantic and still be powerful enough to be detected, to be heard by a killer whale off the coast of Ireland.
Mind-boggling.
Mine, but it is.
It really is. Tell me about polar bears, Doug. Are they graceful, fascinating creatures to deal with, or are they? I always think there's a sort of a sheen of menace beside all that white fur.
Well, I think killer whales can be described as big, sexy, intelligent, charismatic, top-level predators. And what makes them really exciting is that they could and do eat people on a regular basis.
Okay.
So when you go out on the sea ice, you've got to remember that in the Arctic that you are in polar bear habitat. And if one smells you, and they can smell a human from over a mile away, if they're interested in getting close to you, they will use all the guile and cunning that they creep up on seals with. They'll use all that guile and cunning to get close to you. So you always remember when you're out on the sea ice to keep an eye out for polar bears, because the Inuit have a great saying which says it's not the polar bear you can see that's going to get you. So there I am with one down the lens and I'm getting some nice behaviour. Andrew, who's with me, my Inuit guide, he's always looking around anywhere except at that bear that I'm filming, because he knows there could be another one coming up the back of me. But they are, I mean, they're magnificent animals. They're beautifully adapted to where they live. And I think perhaps especially, you know, when you're up there and it's minus 35 and blowing and you've been looking all day and you haven't seen a polar bear, you haven't seen a seal, you haven't seen a bird, you haven't seen anything that a polar bear could possibly survive on. And then right at the end of the day, a polar bear comes out from behind a lump of ice 100 yards away. And that polar bear just looks magnificent. He's fat. He's well fed. The light's behind him. You can see the breath coming out. And you just have to be lost in awe and admiration at how this animal is managing to survive somewhere where you are feeling right on the edge of what you could do and how you could manage. And how on earth is this animal managed to find food where you haven't seen anything living for the last 3 days? I mean, just magnificent.
I would imagine the only type of polar bear you'd want to meet out there, Doug, is a well-fed one, because maybe you'd be too full to have a go at you.
Well, you do have to recognise, you know, that polar bears can be dangerous. The secret to being safe is to see them from a long way away, because you can tell from the way a polar bear begins to approach you whether or not it's likely to be a problem. And we do have the means of getting away from them. Usually we're on snow machines, so you can certainly drive away faster than a polar bear can run after you. But if they do come close, then we've also got cracker shells and even stuff called bear spray, which is like a pepper spray, which is very effective if the bear is downwind from you. You know, you give him a squirt of pepper spray, and if that gets on his nose or his eyes, you know, they're off like a shot. But, as I say, they're an animal that you learn to look out for, and you learn to read the signs of its behaviour. And you try at the same time. You have to keep a respectful distance.
Yes.
You know, the polar bear has a sort of personal space of around about 30, 35 metres round about it. And if it's the right sort of polar bear in the right mood, then you can film within, say, maybe 40, 50 metres, and it will carry on behaving as it does. But if you push in closer than that, the odds are on that you'll put it off and it'll turn away and it'll walk away and it'll stop hunting the seal, which is under the snow, or it'll stop suckling, or, you know, what have you. So, as I say, it's all about having a respect for the animal, having that feeling for where it's sensible to be when you're working round about it.
Mm. The questions I didn't expect I'd be asking this morning, part one. Have you ever pepper sprayed a polar bear, Doug?
I have pepper sprayed a polar bear. It was particularly persistent. And you really don't want to let them get close, Ryan, because once they get within 25 metres, that's the sort of distance that they can charge very quickly. That's how they often grab seals on the surface. And if they start charging, then they can run pretty fast. In fact, I asked an Inuit friend of mine who had been charged by polar bears. I said, how fast do you have to run to get away from them? And he gave the very wise old answer. He said, well, just a little bit faster than whoever is with you.
Sage advice. I'm kind of glad I didn't start the show with I Am the Walrus, because that's a trigger moment for you, Doug.
No, that's right, yeah. That's probably the closest, hairiest thing. I was out snorkeling, so no, there was no diving equipment, just snorkeling, off the ice edge, taking pictures of birds. And suddenly something grabbed me around the thighs. I was treading water at the time, sort of vertical. Suddenly something grabbed me around the thighs, and I looked round, and this walrus had come up from the depths and had wrapped its flippers around my upper legs. And then, just as pure reaction, I swung round and pushed the camera hard against its head, and that surprised the walrus, I suppose, and it let go and swam away a metre or so and then off into the distance. But I think what happened is it had confused me with a seal. Sometimes walrus feed on sleeping seals, and when a seal sleeps, it tends to bob up and down in the water, just like a bottle, just with its nose sticking out. And the walrus, you know, if the walrus is swimming on the surface and it sees that little bobbing head, and they dive down underneath, they come up from below as pure surprise. And so luckily it didn't hold on, didn't pull me down, because quite often when they do haul the seal underwater, one way they have of killing it is to put the lips, the walrus puts its lips against the seal's head and basically sucks its brains out, which is not a good way to go. Well, so luckily it didn't get to that. But no, that's definitely complete surprise. No chance of really taking a deep breath, anything like that. And it is the one time when, you know, as I say, things could have had a very different outcome.
Is there a creature on God's earth that you would love desperately to film at some point that you have yet to capture?
Well, among the small whales, there's a lovely whale called the narwhal, which lives up in the Arctic, and it, of course, is the mythical unicorn. The whales, the male narwhals have got tusks, ivory tusks, just like an elephant tusk, and this thing can come out 3 metres. I mean, a long tusk is 3 metres long, which coming out of the front of a 5.5-metre whale is pretty impressive. And somewhere out there, there might be a friendly male narwhal. They're really quite, the default, the normal behaviour is to keep really quite a long way from you, but somewhere up there, there might be a friendly male narwhal. And if you gave me 20 minutes in his company with a camera, I would be a very happy man.
That's one of your three wishes gone. Okay, let's see what happens. You know, when I'm listening to you talking about the dangers and, you know, the equipment required and everything in between, I do think about those great explorers of the 19th and early 20th century. And I know that Ernest Shackleton is somebody that you're all too familiar with in a good way. And that museum in Athy is a beauty. You're going to be there.
I'm going to be there. They have a Shackleton weekend, so to speak, at the end of October. So I was asked to go down and do a talk. So there's a very interesting range of speakers over that weekend. I think it's the 29th and 30th October. And I'm really looking to going down there and talking.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I'm also doing a tour of theatres in Ireland beginning shortly after that. I'm doing about 14, 15 theatres across Ireland when I'll be talking about the animals and also the explorers and things. So, and all the dates for that are on my website, darryallen.com. But between the two, I mean, I do love talking to the public. And,
yeah,
and the idea of talking at a thigh to a bunch of Shackleton lovers is really very exciting. I'm looking forward to that a lot.
No doubt about it. And you have a place in Galway, don't you?
I've got a wee house out on the west coast, not far from Letterfrack. Had it for a few years, and it's lovely. It's like a wee part of Scotland, which is where I come from, obviously. But it's like a wee part of Scotland, and I've got some very, very good friends out there. In fact, I did a talk just last month. I did a talk at earlier this month, rather, for the Clifton Arts Festival.
Oh, great!
Which is another great wee thing. So it's great to be able to. One of the big things I love about being at this stage in my career, with so much experiences underneath me, is the chance to share those with the public, with schools, with youngsters, oldies, et cetera, and combine that with a message about, you know, what we could and should be doing to help preserve our environment.
Do you show clips of your work in the course of your show, your one-man show?
Yeah, I mix those. I often describe it to people as those 10 minutes that you see at the end of the big series where they go behind the scenes. But my show has a number of examples like that. But I also mix it in with sequences that might be less well-known and talk about how I felt and what we learned about the animal all kinds of things.
It sounds like a lovely way to spend an evening, I have to say.
It's a great way. And I'm really looking forward to doing the FI show and
of
also
course,
all
yeah.
these ones through Ireland. It'll be great fun.
Paula was on to say, we hear the statistics that describe what we are losing in the natural world. I would love to hear Doug describe what he has personally observed over the years to give us a sense of the reality we have to hurry up and deal with it.
Well, this is it. You know, working in the poles is perhaps particularly the Arctic, you know, is one of the most obviously changed places on the planet. And the temperature rise in the Arctic has been already more in the order of 4 or 5 degrees centigrade. And that makes a big difference. In fact, 2 degrees centigrade makes a difference up there. If it's the difference between -1, which is ice, and +1, which is water. So we're definitely seeing big changes up in the Arctic. And that is directly affecting the distribution and the numbers of the animals that, you know, that live up there. One thing to bear in mind about polar bears is polar bears are marine mammals, just like a whale or a seal. The difference between a polar bear and a whale is that a whale lives in the water and a polar bear lives on top of it. And so when you mess around with the on-top component, i.e. the ice, when you degrade it, when you have less of it, when it melts more quickly in the spring, etc., then you're directly affecting the habitat that the polar bears used to exist on. And it may well be that we will have an Arctic in the end where we have fewer polar bears and where they're less widely distributed than they are at the moment. And we need to do all we can to try to arrest climate change. And I have to say that at the moment, generally, you know, the big boys, the politicians and the big vested interest companies that can be in carrying on the way we are, we have to do things differently. It won't be easy, but it is still possible. We just need the willpower coming from the powers that be to do it. And the best way, you know, is for the public to show them, to show the politicians that we are willing and we want them to do the things that we know we need them to do.
Manuel was on to say, are you familiar with an underwater cameraman by the name of Peter Schoons?
I do know Peter Schoons. Sadly, Pete's no longer with us.
So I believe. He said he was a friend of our listener this morning, yes.
No, he was. Pete was a great guy. Pete and I was lucky to work with Pete early on in my career. I mean, Pete started filming back in the 60s. And Pete, like all of us, could have his days when things weren't going so well as others. But I always found him really generous with his advice, and several times he would lend me his camera when we were on the same shoot together. He had a couple of cameras. He would lend me one. And Pete was great. Pete could get images out of a coral reef, more colourful images out of a coral reef than any other camera person around. He absolutely knew how to set up his cameras and get wonderful colours out of them. He was a great character.
You know that road from Ballykeneely to Clifton and that lovely stretches of corals
yes.
on the left
yes.
there? And any mm-hmm. colour, any time of the year, it can go kind of yellowy or cream or white. It's quite something, isn't it?
Oh, I love living by the sea and living in Connemara. But, you know, it's wonderful to live out with nature, especially near water. Mm. You know, water changes all the time with the angle of the sun, with the amount of clouds, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, you never know when you look out in the bay. You might see seals, you might see whale blows, you might see dolphins coming around. You know, I love that fact that it's never the same from one day or even from one hour to the next, and certainly huge changes through the seasons.
Doug, you're just what we needed today. A lovely trip to the poles and underwater, overwater. I really enjoyed our conversation and appreciate your time. And good luck at the Shackleton Museum in Athy. It's a beautiful place, I'm sure you know already. But and your tour of theatres around the country. I think people will really enjoy going to see you. So thank you for your time. Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks very much. Pleasure to talk to you too, Ryan.
Okay.
Cheers.
Best of luck. That's Doug Allan there. And his website is D-O-U-G, Doug Allan, A-L-L-A-N, all one word, dougallan.com for details of that. I think it would be a really gorgeous way to spend, as I say, a couple of hours in his company. And I think as somebody said there, Siobhan said, you could listen to him all day. That's the truth of it. Lovely man. And as I say, a nice little diversion, just what we needed this Monday morning.